Good afternoon. I'm Pat Moore. I'll be your guest host today for Juno Afternoon. And we have a great number of guests lined up this afternoon. We'll be hearing from Tevaka. We'll be hearing from Beth Ligel and Christine Romanoff. And Marie Lavischuk will be here from the Glory Hole with a list of winter needs. Barbara Meyer and Mary Capobianco will be here from the Alaska Literacy Association. We'll find out about an upcoming family night at Gastineau School with guest Mary Folletti. Weather, mostly cloudy, chance of rain in the afternoon, highs around 50, light wanes becoming north, 10 miles per hour in the afternoon. Tonight, the rain likely after midnight, and the lows around 43.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders are gathering in Washington, D.C. to draw attention to Native issues. They're launching Tribal Unity Impact Week today. The leaders are calling on lawmakers to acknowledge and recommit themselves to top issues like federal trust responsibility, land restoration, and protecting Native women. The National Congress of American Indians and the United South and Eastern Tribes are co-hosting Unity Week events. At the recent National Indian Health Board annual conference in Alaska, participants discussed ways to convince Congress to keep the special diabetes program for Indians. It's funded through 2013. Some worry with the nation's economic climate, Congress may not maintain the program despite its successes. Jocelyn Estes reports.
Diabetes among Native Americans is twice the rate of non-natives. Marvin Defoe of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa in Wisconsin says it affects nearly all Native Americans.
If you go in any Native community, you ask your community how many of you know of somebody who has the disease of diabetes, and 95% of the community is going to raise their hand.
Oklahoma Choctaw Gail Marshall of the American Diabetes Association says the program has saved lives and saved money by preventing diabetes-related complications.
In about the same time, 10-year period of the Special Diabetes Program for Indian funding, Special Diabetes Program for Indians funding, we saw a 30% decrease in diabetes-related dialysis. When it is in all of the research and in all of the studies, all the other populations were seeing an increase.
Despite its successes, Marshall says the nation's economic climate may make it hard to maintain the special diabetes program for Indians. Reporting in Anchorage, Alaska, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
A South Dakota Indian school is beginning a new expansion project. When completed, the school will have a new alumni center and additional space for its museum. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
Officials with St. Joseph's Indian School in Chamberlain, South Dakota, have been discussing the expansion project for about 4 years. Their original goal was to create more climate-controlled space for the Acta Lakota Museum, which is located on school property. Late last week, the school broke ground on a $3 million addition, which will include the extra museum space and an alumni center. Reverend Stephen Hofstetter, the school's executive director, says plans also include a medicine wheel garden to bring about healing and reconciliation. Officials are working with a Minneapolis design firm to help plan the structure. There's no immediate word on when the project will be finished. The Catholic-run institution has been open since 1927, with about 200 students residing on the school's central South Dakota campus. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbold.
The New Mexico Department of Health and Tribes are hosting health and wellness events. The health organization Project Hope is also offering screenings and education during the Tribal Preventative Health Week. Its state-of-the-art mobile health unit will make stops at tribal communities. The 64-foot office on wheels will offer screenings for diabetes, blood pressure, cholesterol, and body mass index. The goal of the week is to reduce risk of disease and encourage people to make healthy choices. On this day in 1996, KNBA, the first urban all-native radio station, went on the air. The station is located in Anchorage, Alaska. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. With funding by the Washington, D.C. and Alaska law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Munson, defending Native American interests throughout the United States.
If you are a Native American who experienced discrimination from the USDA while trying to get a farm loan, you could get a payment of up to $50,000 or more. There will be meetings in locations around the country between July and December 2011 where you can get free legal help filing a claim. More details and a full schedule of meetings is available at IndianFarmClass.com or 1-888-233-5506.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
My first guest this afternoon is actually not here in the studio with me, but is in Thousand Oaks, California, and is going to be coming to Juneau fairly soon here. His name is Opataya Fowahi. And can you hear me, Opata?
Yes, I can.
Good. And you're sitting in beautiful Thousand Oaks, California. It's raining here. What's it doing there?
Oh, it's beautiful, fine weather here.
Good. Well, I'm glad. Anyway, your group, Tevaka, we've been playing lots of cuts off of your CD over the last several weeks, kind of getting everyone ready for a concert, which is going to happen here in Juneau on the evening of the 16th of October. And you, you're one of the musicians in the group, is that right?
Yes, I am. Yes.
And which musician are you?
Well, I'm actually the main thing I do is I'm actually the songwriter of the group. And but I'm the also because I write them, I sing them as well, and play acoustic guitar.
So how many people make up Tevaka?
Well, at the moment, there's seven performing on stage, but a lot of people, after the show, they think it's, they think it's 12 or 13 people because the dancers switch from percussion to vocals, there's various instrumentation going on and of seven piece.
Give me an idea of what you'll perform when you're here. Will it be like a two-hour concert, or and what's the setting?
Yes, I'm told that we're doing 2 by 50-minute sets, which is which comes, I guess, to 110 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it'll be we have seven albums out now, so we basically shift from songs set to set because we like to so many songs that we like to play. But basically, it's a bit from the seven albums, and it's a lot of percussion, a lot of dance, and of course some of the songs.
Now, when the whole seven, but closer to 10 people ensemble with everyone switching roles up on the stage, what will we see?
You will see. Well, it's a very fast pace because we carry a lot of costumes as well. So between, you'll see a lot of costume changes going on as well. So there's a line. There is a standard drum kit, the keyboards, there's an electric guitar, flute. I'm on acoustic. And there's a line of log drums in the middle. And we switch from playing log drums. And, of course, the dancers are dancing in front of us. So throughout that entire show, there are interchanges going on between percussion, dance, and song.
So if I come to this show, I'll hear music from where? What kinds of sources come into Tevaka's music?
Well, I'm very much inspired by the traditional music of the South Pacific. But what I write is basically a fusion. It's a fusion of many Pacific islands and of course, the European influence that I'm also influenced by. So it's a mix of all that. So, this is... But you'll definitely see the traditional, very heavy influence at the traditional costumes, traditional drumming, that goes on throughout the show.
Opataya, you say you have a European influence. Where does that come from?
Well, because, you know, I was actually brought up and born in Samoa. My mother comes from Tuvalu, and my father comes from Tokelau. Actually, it's amazing. Those two islands are in center stage in the news at the moment from the South Pacific because they are running out of water. They are sinking. You know, so I'm getting emails daily asking if we would, when we return, to do a fundraising event for those two islands. Yes, yeah, so those two islands and, of course, Samoa, their traditional dance, a very, very strong influence on our, and the Cook Islands as well, on our music, on my music.
I'm trying to put this together in my head. And I'm hearing lots of drums and singing in other languages, and then modern kind of like string instrumentation as well. So is there a jazz-like component to this as well?
You know, it's quite difficult for me to actually describe it because I'm the songwriter, so I write what comes out naturally. I guess, yes, I guess it's it's really the listener that can, I guess if you've listened to the album, I guess you could probably describe it better than I can, what you can hear in there.
Well, I have to say that it's extremely exciting music. It seems like the pieces that I've heard on Havili move, am I saying that correctly, by the way?
Yes, Havili, you're pronouncing my name and that word perfectly.
Oh, good. the pieces vary. There's quite a range in tempos. Some of the stuff is almost sad. And yeah. I noticed there were a couple of pieces in there that had an almost, well, there's one children's piece on the record that has a kind of an anti-war sentiment to the lyrics.
Yes, yes. I guess being a songwriter, I'm influenced by what's happening in the world of today. And you know, that song, which is called, what's a children's song, it basically takes the viewpoint of the children looking at what's going on. The adults, you know, all these wars going on, and, you know, the children suffer. And they're going, you know, they, and really the song is sung from their point of view of, hey, guys, what about us? You know, we have feelings too. What are you doing, you know, destruction all about us. We see blood spilt, and you know, where's our protection? You know, things like that. So, yeah, I think as a songwriter, I also express, like other songwriters, what's happening in the world today.
And this is we're talking about Tamaiti Uma.
Tamaiti Uma. That's
Tamaiti Uma. Okay,
yeah.
And it means all children when it's translated.
Yes.
Yeah, but then you go from there to another one of these songs several of the songs which seem to almost be like a celebration of the world and its beauty and like that.
Yes, because I believe that you know, all these destructive things that are happening, you know, they're greatly outnumbered. There are really a few destructive forces happening, but I believe in the goodness that there are a majority of people in this world that, you know, that are trying to do good, you know, trying to bring back the humanity, the values of us as humans, and things like that. So that theme is very strong in the album, although I couldn't help but express those things that were happening, the sad parts that were happening in the world today.
What language do you write in?
I write in Pacific language, but mainly in the language of Tokelau. Tokelau is an island that has three islands, combined land mass only comes to 4 square miles, but I find the language of Tokelau very, very rhythmical, and I find it very comfortable to write in. So apart from three songs that I've been commissioned to write, like from Greenpeace, I was asked to write one in English. There's another film that I was asked to write a love song in English, and another one I can't quite remember, but I love writing in a Pacific language because it helps to keep the Pacific languages alive. You know, there's enough people writing in English, and I'm trying to keep our languages alive in my own way.
Well, you're coming to a place where we're also trying to keep native languages alive. That's a major thrust at the University of Alaska Southeast here in Juneau.
Oh, fantastic.
And so perhaps you'll have some time to look into some of the Tlingit language things that are going on while you're here.
Oh, definitely interested, yes.
Right. Well, the concert with Opetaia Fawai, I'll get it right next time. Fawai will be on the 16th. I believe it starts at 7 o'clock here in Juneau. Let me get the location real quick. It's at the JDHS, Juneau Douglas High School Auditorium. Opetaia, thank you very much for taking some time out of your day and telling us about this upcoming concert, and we look forward to hearing your songs when you're here.
Thank you very much, Pat, for having me on your show.
You bet. Bye. Te Vaca. They'll be playing here in Juneau on October 16th at JDHS Auditorium at 7 p.m. Tickets are on sale all around town right now. My next guest today is Beth Weigel. I knew I'd do it wrong. And Beth and I are going to be talking together about the Juneau Children's Outdoor Community Coalition.
That's right.
So I understand that this starts with a tough quiz question.
Okay, well, I'll just give you the quiz question right off the top, so
okay.
it'll give you a little sense.
Does everyone have a pencil and paper handy so that they can write down the question?
All right, this is a true or false question.
Okay.
True or false, today's children may be the first generation at risk of having a shorter lifespan than their parents.
Mm.
What do you think, Pat?
Well, awful thought. Shorter lifespan than their parents.
So I'm gonna
say that I don't think that that's so, but
well,
I'll say false.
That would be wrong.
Well,
so
true. Do we have an extra credit question I can get a makeup on?
Well, I could give you one maybe a little later if we have time. But
okay.
Basically, there's been an increase in sedentary indoor lifestyles, and it's contributed to childhood chronic conditions like childhood obesity. Here in Alaska, that's 1 in 10. Children are obese, and asthma, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and vitamin D deficiency. Obviously, that's a problem here. We don't have a lot of sunlight to begin with. And if we have more emphasis on promotion of outdoor activity in nature, that would perhaps help change that statistic or change that to being a false thing.
But without moving away from sedentary lifestyles, we run the risk of having our children live less long than we do.
Right, and developing some of these problems like obesity, like vitamin D deficiency, like type 2 diabetes, which used to be, you know, adult onset. Now it's prevalent in children, heart issues for children, you know, a lot of these issues that, you know, ADHD is a common thing. So all these things, a lot of time spent outside can start to change those conditions and help alleviate some of those problems. And so that's what our coalition is bound to try and do, is to get children outside. And we started a couple years ago, and it's a coalition, so it means that lots of different organizations and individuals have come together to work collaboratively to try and help promote getting kids outside. And we've done a couple of really cool things over the past couple years, had some successes, and some of those things people may have remembered from participating in them. We've had a, you know, a Juno Children's clothing exchange, because we know how fast kids grow out of their boots and their rain gear and things like that that they need to get outside, good outerwear. So we've had that come in, bring your kids stuff that they've outgrown, pick up something else that you might, you know, need for your kid. Even if you couldn't bring anything, you could come and pick things up. We also have now a Get Outdoors Alaska website, which was part of our initiative to help promote things in the communications world. We wanted to see if people could, you know, work collaboratively to not schedule some of their events and activities at the same time as other people. So we try to list a lot of our activities on this Get Outdoors Alaska. And that's exactly what the website is, www.getoutdoorsalaska.org. It's actually a statewide website. You can filter it to bring it down to just Juno. And, for example, I'm the director for Discovery Southeast. We list our events there. I know that a variety of other organizations in the community do as well when they have outdoor events for their kids or for even adults at times. But it's a great resource that people can learn about. And that was inspired and spearheaded through our coalition. Also, here in Alaska, we're also trying to put together the Alaska Environmental Literacy Plan. Once we have a plan in place statewide, then we can hopefully bring in some money to help fund some other things if our No Child Left Inside initiatives in D.C. get passed through. So you can learn more about the Alaska Environmental Literacy Plan as well through our coalition. A couple other fun events that we've had. We had a spring equinox jamboree out at the Saga Eel Valley Center that we all contributed to last spring. We very well may do that again this year. We contributed to the Alaska Association for the Education of Young Children's conference last year. We all collaborated and helped support that. It was Beaches, Boots, and Blueberries, all about kids and learning outside. So a lot of agencies have come together and individuals from the community have come together to try and move forward and take action in this area. And we want to invite some more people to come to our, we have two meetings a year, and this Thursday at 5 o'clock, we're going to have our next semi-annual meeting. We'll be meeting at the Bill Ray Center on the second floor there. And we are going to have a little quick outdoor activity. So be prepared to go outside, and we'll have some refreshments and spend a couple hours talking about what's next for the coalition. What are some things people want to work on?
So this is going to be a, kind of like an open table meeting of the coalition partners?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And who are the primary partners in the coalition?
Well, Kristen Romanoff at Alaska Fish and Game, she pretty much spearheaded this whole movement for us to bring this coalition together. There's been a national movement, of course, through the Children and Nature Network, if you're familiar with Richard Louv's work, Last Child in the Woods, and now he has a new book out called The Nature Principle. He helped found the Children and Nature Network. So she's been going to a variety of conferences and had learned a lot about this, and she started this coalition here. And some of the primary partners that started with her, I guess, would be my organization, Discovery Southeast, Darren Snyder at the UAS Extension Office with 4-H. He's been a partner. AEYC, Joy Lyon, and those folks over there at the Association for the Education of Young Children, they've been a partner. Saga, of course, has been partners with it. The Forest Service, we've had people from NOAA come. We've had just community members who are unaffiliated maybe with any organization. We've had Big Brothers Big Sisters folks come. So it's rotated. A lot of different people have come throughout the last couple years. DIPAC has been there a couple times. So we really wanted to get as many interested people who are really focused on this to come to the coalition meeting. And I know, you know, some other people have been inspired by it. And I know there was a preschool group of parents that really are determined to have their kids outside during their care time. And they've created sort of an outdoor preschool. So we've had a variety of different people inspired by the coalition. We have some activities that we like to try and accomplish within the coalition. So we invite anybody who has an interest in wanting to help promote getting kids outside.
So how long do these meetings normally last if you start at 5 o'clock?
It'll probably be a couple hours.
Yeah,
5
okay.
to 7 is what we have it scheduled for. And if you can come for part of the time or all the time, that'd be great. Like I said, we're going to gather at the Bill Ray Center there on the second floor and in the big conference room there. And then we'll go and do a quick little 30 minutes outside. So if you're thinking, oh, I can't get there till 5:30, that would be great just to come then because we'll have completed our little outdoor venture and be back inside. So it'll be
but if
perfect
you can get there at 5, you
yep.
can take advantage
exactly.
of the outdoor thing as well.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and probably won't last too much past 7-ish.
Exactly.
Kind of mm-hmm. thing. Okay, so still time to get home and do a couple of things.
Yep, and if you have questions, you can certainly give me a call. I'm sort of co-chairing the coalition this year with Kristen Romanoff, and you can call our office at Discovery Southeast at 463-1500 if you have a question.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you very much for coming down and telling us about
Thank
this.
Thank you.
I hope you find some people.
Bye.
We're going to take a walk outside today. Going to see what we can find today. We're going to take a walk outside today. Going to see what we can find today. On a pretty little farm, the sun comes up. On a curious cat and a pug-nosed pup. A brand new life outside the door. Follow your nose and go explore. 'Cause we're going to take a walk outside today. Going to see what we can find today. We're going to take a walk outside today. Going to see what we can find today. Big world is all set up for a curious cat and a pug-nosed pup. Friends to meet, places to be, it's all so new and fun to see. And we're going to take a walk outside today. Going to see what we can find today. We're going to take a walk outside today. Going to see what we can find today. The journey's over and we're heading back home. With a very good friend, you're never alone. Stories to tell, stories to hear. Be a lot more in the coming year. We're going to take a walk outside today. Going to see what we can find today.
Little music there about walking outside with Dan Crow. Sort of the tagline to our guest who just told us about the Outdoor Community Coalition meeting coming up Thursday night. Right now, I'm here in the studio with Barbara Meyer and Mary Capobianco, who are going to talk to us about another program of interest to probably a group of people, but a little indoors, I guess, this time, unless you want to take your book out on an October day and read with the leaves and a little bit of rain falling down on your head. It's 28 minutes after 3, and my two guests are Barbara Meyer and Mary Capobianco. So tell me about the Alaska State Literacy Association.
The Alaska State Literacy Association, this is Mary, is a statewide organization, obviously, and its purpose is to promote literacy throughout all different disciplines and curriculums. And in conjunction with the Juneau Haines Reading Council, the local council, the local affiliate, and the school district, we are putting on a statewide conference called Digging Deeper, Mining for Meaning Across the Disciplines. And our focus with that conference is to provide professional development for teachers and paraprofessionals that looks to strategies that they can use in their classrooms to help deepen understanding of whether it's more than just reading a book. It's reading a math book or reading a science book or reading a history book. The strategies that will help kids get a better understanding of what they are trying to learn.
So your primary target for the literacy stuff is children?
It's students. It's K through 12.
Ah, okay.
And the people who are going to be attending are going to be teachers from Juneau, the Juneau district, and then also other teachers statewide.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Barbara, are you an instructor or part of the association?
I have several connections. I'm the co-president of the local Juneau Haynes Reading Council, along with Janet Lopez. And I'm also employed by the school district as a secondary instructional coach. So literacy is my primary focus. So there's two connections there.
Okay.
And then I've been involved on this conference, helping on the there's a small committee of really hardworking people. Mary is the co-chair of the event, along with Paula Krellbrenner. So I've been by her side or in the background helping weave this all together. It's happening this next coming Monday and Tuesday at Thunder Mountain High School.
And what are the times?
The first workshop, the keynote speakers are beginning their presentations at 8:30, and then it'll go throughout a typical school day. Is that right, Mary?
That's right. There'll be three keynote speakers, and we are absolutely thrilled that we are able to bring up. These are nationally and actually internationally known people that are coming to Juneau, Doug Fisher, Nancy Frey, and Marcia Invernese. And they are our keynote speakers, and they're targeted to specific kind of not content areas as much as grade level areas. And so, depending on what area you teach, you'll either go to Doug or Nancy or Marcia Invernese. And they'll do the keynotes from like 8:30 to 8:45 or something. Longer than 15 minutes. And then what they'll do is they'll go into other sessions, some of which are done by Doug Fisher and Nancy Frey, and then other people from the district and other people statewide are coming in to also make presentations. And so it's all focused on that reading and comprehension throughout all disciplines.
Monday must be an in-service day.
Monday and Tuesday are both in-service
days.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So that's how we're reaching to teachers.
That's
with
right.
This program. Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. So I take it that one of the reasons you're here is because teachers have a choice about what they might want to do with the in-service time, and so this is one of the options that they have. It certainly sounds like a fascinating one if you're at all interested in increasing literacy, which is really the key to education.
So. Absolutely. We don't have a program with us right now, but we've designed the conference to have sort of strands that would be like the K1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 through 12, so that you could focus on the kinds of things that would be the most helpful to you as you are going back into your classroom. I mean, it's not like we don't want to have other additional knowledge that we can just think about, but we want to have something that is really practical for people to sort of put in their pocket, come out the next day and go, you know, I can tweak what I'm doing and use it in my classroom. And this is the way for me to help students get a better understanding of what they're doing.
Now, will there be any possibility of people who are not associated with the school district but who might want to take part in these sessions to attend them?
Well, I think it's mainly targeted for it is targeted for classroom teachers or the paraprofessionals that are in the classrooms helping them.
Okay.
It's not as though that the information wouldn't be interesting, but I'm not sure necessarily how applicable it would be if you have children and you want it. So it's really for teachers.
So this
mainly.
Go ahead.
Well, I guess I can kind of see partly what you're wondering about. Sometimes I think parents or community members wonder, well, why are my kids home from school? But the new philosophy about keeping our teachers on top of their training is to offer state-of-the-art, up-to-date opportunities to stay in tune with what's going on with education. And so this is a two-day opportunity to help teachers grab onto some new tools for their toolbox and to keep our teaching effective, to make their teaching explicit around the topic of literacy. And we often talk about we wouldn't have surgery from a doctor who doesn't keep up on his practice. And so these are 2 days where we're offering teachers some pretty special opportunities from people here in Juneau, but also from outside the district, who are highly skilled at offering the highly practical new ways to think about helping kids achieve in our classrooms.
After the 2-day conference is over, then if someone is inspired by the material that they hear, mm-hmm. is there then follow-up of some kind? Is there assistance for teachers in the classroom?
Well, we have the instructional coaches in each of those, in each of the schools, and that would be one avenue to pursue. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing that when we were trying to design what would be the most useful 2 days so that you have good things in your toolbox would be you could learn things and then take them back. The school district is embracing sort of the professional learning community. That's why we have the early release. And so these are things that you could be, as in a language arts cadre or a math cadre, bringing back to your professional learning community the next time you meet and talking about, well, what about this strategy? Is this something that we want to embrace? Do we want to try this, you know, as and see how effective it is with our kids? So it is something to design to be practical and useful and, you know, something that they could use kind of right away.
Mm-hmm. So during the end service on Monday and Tuesday, mm-hmm. the program is sponsored by the Alaska State Literary Association. It's a professional mm-hmm. development institute, and it's bringing three keynote speakers. Mm-hmm. Did we say three or four?
Three
keynote speakers up from outside professionals in the field and like that. Mm-hmm. So that's what the teachers will be doing during the end service mm-hmm. on Monday and Tuesday. Well, thank you very much for coming down and telling us about that.
Well, thanks for the opportunity.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 11th of October, 2011. Birthday of novelist Elmore Leonard, born New Orleans, 1925. Learned to write by reading, especially Hemingway and Steinbeck. Still keeps a picture of Hemingway in his office. At the beginning of his career, wasn't sure whether to focus on Westerns or crime novels, decided on Westerns. They were easier to publish at the time. The genre was popular. And that's what he wrote through the 1950s, but then turned his same very succinct plot-driven style to writing crime novels, novels that include Glitz, Get Shorty, Rum Punch, and most recently, Djibouti. Author of more than 40 novels, Elmore Leonard, soon as he finishes one, starts on another. Published a famous piece of advice for writers 10 years ago, in which he gave 10 rules, things like never open a book with weather, never use a verb other than said to carry dialogue, avoid detailed descriptions of characters, try to leave out the parts that readers tend to skip. He said, think of what you skip reading a novel. Thick paragraphs of prose you can see have too many words in them. What the writer is doing, he's writing, perpetrating hoop-de-doodle, perhaps taking another shot at the weather, or has gone into the character's head, and the reader either knows what the guy's thinking or doesn't care. My most important rule is one that sums up the 10. If it sounds like writing, I rewrite it. It's the birthday of the French novelist François Mauriac, born in Bordeaux, 1885. He was staunchly Catholic in an era when Albert Camus and Jean-Paul Sartre were bringing existential philosophy into French culture. Mauriac, too conservative for progressives, not Catholic enough for the Catholic establishment. Got into a famous dispute with Albert Camus after World War II. Camus felt that every Nazi collaborator should be ferreted out and given a harsh punishment. Mauriac had been a member of the resistance, but he took issue with Camus, arguing that France should focus on unity, not on punishing collaborators. They attacked each other for a time. He continued writing, publishing, until his death at the age of 84 in 1970. Here's a poem for today by Dean Young, Changing Genres. I was satisfied with haiku until I met you, jar of octopus, cuckoo's cry, 575. But now I want a Russian novel, a 50-page description of you sleeping, another 75 of what you think staring out a window. I don't care about the plot, although I suppose there will have to be one, the usual separation of the lovers, turbulent seas, danger of decommission in spite of constant war, time in gulps and glitches, passing squibs of threnody, a fallen nest, speckled eggs somehow uncrushed, the sled outracing the wolves on the steps, the huge glittering ball where all that matters is a kiss at the end of a dark hall. At dawn, the officers ride back to the garrison, one without a glove, the entire last chapter about a necklace that couldn't be worn, inherited by a great niece, along with the love letters, bound in silk. Changing Genres, a poem by Dean Young, from Fall Higher, published by Copper Canyon Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by CenturyLink, a new kind of broadband company linking Americans coast to coast with consistently fast speeds and personal service. More at CenturyLink.com. And by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight, nearly 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel, to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. Produced by our technical director, Thomas Schweitzker. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 20 minutes to 4, and my next guest in the studio is well known around town, even though she's been the executive director for just, as we established, 2.5 years. It's Maria Lovischuk, who is the executive director of the Glory Hole. Hi, Maria.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah. So we're going to eventually, as we wander through this, get to some of the needs that are coming up for winter. But the first question I wanted to ask you is, last year they came in with shovels and all kinds of equipment and terraced the side of the cliff behind the Glory Hole, and you're growing part of your food. How did your garden grow?
The garden grew great. It actually exceeded all of my expectations. My favorite thing was that I was essentially kept out of the garden because the patrons did pretty much all the work, and we had the slow foods, which are folks from this group in town, come over and help them. But basically, yeah, the Glory Hole patrons maintained it, harvested everything. We got to incorporate it into our food. We had a really good harvest, and next year I think we're going to triple it because now we actually know what we're doing. But the amazing thing was just really how people took to the program and were excited about eating new vegetables, learning about new vegetables. I had staff members who, and patrons who did not know, you know, what kale was, what chard was, you know, what peas grew off the bush, and folks got to experience that and grow that. And I think what's really good, and I think it's just going to keep on getting better and better every year.
So, Maria, you said something before we, while we were listening to Garrison, you said that the next thing that we kind of need to all be aware of is that the holidays are coming faster than we think they are, and particularly the Glory Hole has some needs around the holidays.
Right, and so we give out holiday food boxes for those folks who have homes but cannot afford to get their own Thanksgiving and Christmas meals. And last year we gave out about 347 of those boxes for Christmas and Thanksgiving. And so we have to start gearing up for that. And usually folks kind of wait until it's about Thanksgiving or Christmas, and then we don't have anything, and then kind of a couple of days before we have everything. And so we are really hoping to get a little bit better prepared this year. And so if folks wanted to donate turkeys, mashed potatoes, you know, like just potatoes or mashed potatoes mixes, canned corn, canned beans, canned peas, cranberry sauce, and basically anything you would want to eat for Thanksgiving, but right now is not perishable. We'll get to the pies and butter and rolls a little bit later. But it'd be a great time to just kind of start dropping it by, and they can drop it by at the Glory Hole any day between 7 and 9:30. It would really be great to be a little bit more prepared. And those folks who are listening who need to sign up for the Thanksgiving and Christmas boxes should do so by calling us at the Glory Hole, 586-4159. And the sooner you do this, the better it will be. And also you can email us at theglorihole@gci.net.
Maria, if you could design the perfect holiday gift basket, what would you put in it?
Okay, it would have a really nice turkey. It would have potatoes. It would have a really nice homemade pie. It would have corn. It would have beans. It would have peas. It would have rolls. It would have butter. It would have a little thing of whipped cream so we can whip it and put it on their nice pie. And then, you know, it's nice to stick a little surprise in there. Some people put, like, a few oranges, you know, just kind of to cheer it up. So I think that would be my idea of a good Thanksgiving box.
So if people are thinking, I wonder what I could prepare for this, those would be the places to concentrate.
The items to bring, yeah. And also, if they want us to go buy this stuff for them, they can just write us a check and send it to us, and then we will be very happy to do the shopping.
And another ideal question is, if you had all of this stuff and you could pack the boxes, when would you like to have it by?
They usually try to have all the boxes given out by, at the latest, the Tuesday of the Thanksgiving week. So, you know, and we have a nice new freezer, thanks to Rasmussen Foundation. So we would be, and the Chapel by the Lake folks, so we would be really happy to start collecting it now.
We'll take it any time.
Yeah, we'll take it any time.
But the fresh foods and like that need to come to the glory hole about when?
About
pie or something like that.
About the Thanksgiving week by. So we always say by, you know, Sunday is the cutoff, Sunday before Thanksgiving, but then it ends up not being Sunday before Thanksgiving at all. So
they're coming in all
so
the time.
So there's essentially no cutoff.
But everyone who can possibly get the stuff to you by Sunday before Thanksgiving,
or
it makes
possibly,
your life a
you
lot
know,
easier.
Start now. I
yeah,
mean,
start
if they start now, it would just
and
be
frozen
great.
Foods and like
and
that.
We'll be back again to see you closer to the holidays.
Good.
So we'll remind folks.
Well, come on a Tuesday or a Friday. Those are the days I guess to host.
Okay.
Anyway, so now Christmas is the same kind of package?
Christmas is the same kind of package. And Christmas, you know, so Thanksgiving, we really kind of focus on turkeys. Christmas, we get more hams. So Christmas, you can get a ham or a turkey.
Mm-hmm.
And we also, you know, give out Christmas presents to all of our patrons. And so that's another thing we're going to start preparing for. But now, another thing that they're focusing on now is the camping supplies
yes.
for outside folks. So if people have extra camping gear, tents, sleeping bags, sleeping pads, tarps, blue tarps especially are great without too many holes in them. We're also collecting those things so that we can distribute it to our folks who are going to be camping this winter.
And so those things can be brought to the glory hole as well?
Mm-hmm. Anytime between 7 and 9.
Okay, and then you said socks, I think?
Oh, and together with the Front Street Clinic, we are starting our socks, hats, and gloves, and warm coat drives. And so we do this at Front Street Clinic every year because one of the biggest items that we get asked for are socks and gloves and also clean underwear. So if anybody, and I think that we're going to be setting up some drives at the malls, and some folks will be working on that. But if anybody wants to contribute something useful, socks, hats, gloves, scarves, that would be a wonderful thing to drop by as well.
Okay, wonderful. Is there anything else that people can do for you at the Glory Hole?
Well, there's always donate money, because that is always very helpful. We do get a tremendous amount of community support already. But, yeah, basically, if we could focus right now on stuff for the holiday food boxes as well as camping stuff and hats, socks, and gloves, that would be really great.
Wonderful. Maria, you do a wonderful job. Thank you very much for
Thank
coming
you very,
and talking
very
with us.
Much for having me.
Letting have a snowball fight. You might not get back home until tomorrow night. I ran out through the back door. I passed Mom. She said, hold it there, child. Put your new boots on. Better than the old, my new boots. My feet will never get cold. New boots, they're all shiny and red. The first time that I had them, I wore them to bed. By the end of last year, they didn't fit at all. My feet had got too big, all my boots had got too small. And they were orange and ugly. They had holes in the bottom. I saw a pair of red ones and my mom went out and got them. Now I feel like the coolest kid. Both of my feet.
about 10 minutes until 4, and my guests in the studio right now are Mary Folletti, and Ishmael Hope. And welcome. We're going to talk about family night at Gastineau School. Is that right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So tell me what's going on.
Well, on this coming Thursday, the 13th, we're going to do a family night at Gastineau Elementary School, and that includes all students and families. And we have, they're actually supported by Gold Belt Heritage Foundation under the Wu Qin Grant. And this is a grant that works to infuse cultural education and Tlingit language in the Juneau School District, K through 8. TANF funds are also provided from Tlingit and Haida to support these programs. And we try to do it on a monthly basis and provide food and some sort of activity or entertainment for the families and students. And I really enjoy collaborating. So we're going to have ANS, Alaska Native Sisterhood Camp 70. They're going to cater our dinner for us. And I got a hold of Ishmael Hope, Kogwask. He's a Kiksedi man. Him and his wife, his new wife, Lily, not Hudson anymore, Hope. And they're going to come and tell us some stories.
Wonderful. So, Ishmael, you're famous in Juneau.
Oh,
so,
I don't know about that.
The family night sounds like it has a very Native orientation, but it also sounds like you're trying to reach out across the whole community. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I would say that. I work for Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, and I am in the schools, and I teach Tlingit language to all the classrooms, K through fifth grade in the school. And part of my job is also to bring together family nights, and they're not always culturally oriented, but that's definitely one of my goals, and it does reach school-wide.
Something that Mary's really doing is she was one of the people that this new generation of people that came out as Tlingit language learners and being just a real leader in that. And there are other folks, too, like one of the instructors at the university, Lance Twitchell, Kune, he started working there and is doing the program, Tlingit language program with Richard Downhauer. And so, yeah, Mary has just taken this leadership. She, you know, became a teacher and is teaching language and the culture to the young people. And I just think that's a great thing.
Earlier in the program, my first guest was a fellow who's coming up with a group of South Pacific singers and dancers called Te Vaka. They're going to play here on the 16th.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things that he said is that he writes in the language of a small island because in the South Pacific, which is where his father was born. And the reason is because he's trying to keep the language alive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's
and
huge.
I mentioned to him that while he was here, perhaps he'd want to look into some of the things that are going on with Tlingit and Haida language.
Well, one thing about if you only speak one language, it's a little bit harder to understand that a language isn't just another way of saying things. It's just this whole beautiful worldview. It's this important intellectual and spiritual heritage. And so every opportunity we get, we try to share the value of the language. And just as far as you know, writing language, there's a Facebook page called Chas Hayu Atungi, and
which means
it means only our language or our language immersion. And so you'd only speak, you'd only write in the language in whatever orthography you choose. And, you know, it's a second language, definitely for me. I'm just barely learning it, but I still try to do the writing, write oratory before I have a chance to speak it. If I have a chance, a culturally appropriate chance, I'll write it out and then speak it out, because that's the tools I have. You know, you try to just make use of what you have.
It's really difficult because it's absolutely backwards from the way people naturally learn language. I mean,
yes.
You know, as a baby, you just hear it all the time. And the Tlingit people used to even say, they still say it, when you're in the womb, you're hearing the language of your mother. And so now we're adults and we're trying to learn a language of our grandparents. And We have to start with the writing system before we move on to the oral. But
upside down. Yes.
Yes, it is. Yeah. It's backwards. And I mean, I think that we're doing the best that we can, and Ishmael's very committed to it. I mean, aren't you the one who started that page on Facebook?
Yeah.
It's nice to see the community growing. There's not a lot of us who are learning and really doing something with it. And so I've been seeing this growth. It's like a paradigm shift in where we're at. And I think really the more we get of us as older people, I think we're really going to tap into the younger generations.
Something the great Ong'ayokuk Oscar Coigley said, he passed away in April. He's an amazing Yubik scholar. He said, when you learn your heritage language, you get into the thought world of the ancestors, the thought world of the ancestors. And, you know, even if I'm never going to be completely fluent, it's like James Crippen Zeosh says, it's a journey. And it helps you get into that thought world, which is just, it holds you up.
Can you give me an example?
There we go.
So
there's lots of various phrases in my mind, but I know I could. I'll probably just need a few more minutes to piece it together to feel satisfactory to be able to share it. But yeah, that's just a little bit.
My question really, I was trying to get an illustration of how the worldview is different because of the language.
Oh, the worldview.
But I'd kind of like that in English rather.
the worldview is different than English because English is incredible at a sort of hyper articulation in certain things. There's, you got so many words and adjectives and you learn how to use sort of abstract language. What an indigenous heritage language will do is much more closer to the ground, close to the land in which you live, and to me, I think if you learn that language, and it's, to me personally, it's for everybody, because you learn much more of a sort of that what people say connection to land. Well, the language really helps you do that, because the language, to me, is a living thing. It's a living thing, and that's been living on this area for thousands of years.
Yes.
And so when you do that, you just open it up. You open up your experience of the life that is around you.
So, Ishmael, Mary, the event is at Gastineau School.
Yep, in the gymnasium.
In the gymnasium, when? What day?
It's October 13th, this Thursday,
okay,
from 5:30 to 7.
Okay.
And you'll be hearing Tlingit language, Tlingit stories, eating Tlingitized food, spaghetti, served by Alaska Native Sisterhood Camp 70.
Uh-huh. And is there's no fee?
There's no fee. It's a free family night dinner, and it's hosted by Gold Belt Heritage Foundation.
And so the whole family's invited to the
whole
thing?
Family, yep, okay. And community members, if anybody would like to come.
So you don't have to be associated with Gastineau School to...
I'm going to say no. I mean,
okay.
I think that Gastineau is a part of the larger community. So,
right.
I mean, we're all part of this community together.
Okay, wonderful. Michelle, wonderful to have you in the studio.
And two quick things.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm just going to look forward to sharing with my lovely wife. I'd have to say that, my lovely wife, Lily Hope. And I wanted to congratulate Jeff Brown for winning the Lifetime Achievement Award with Alaska Humanities. I just think he's totally and completely deserving. As the listeners in the show know, he's just a good person in this community. And so it's good. It's always great to see that kind of recognition happen.
Wonderful. Thank you very, very much for coming down and sharing this.
Good cheese.
So that will be pretty much the conclusion of today's Juno afternoon. Tomorrow, Jeff will be talking with Aaron Elmore from Theater in the Rough. Elizabeth Dubofsky will be here to highlight the week's Slow Food Potluck, the showing of the film and ingredients, and we'll talk about the extended run of Perseverance Theater's play, The 39 Steps. This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay, tuned to K276AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, it's K269AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201AM at 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210AS at 89.9. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable, Juneau on digital channel 871, KRNN at 872, KXLL on 873. And we're also online at www.ktoo.org.
Today, October 11th. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Robert Siegel.
Officials say the plotters plan to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the U.S.
Also this hour, thousands of people may have been exposed to listeria and cantaloupe.
Probably a lot of people ate this cantaloupe. A lot of people probably ate a lot of listeria on the cantaloupe.
So, why didn't they get sick? And 20 years ago, Clarence Thomas was confirmed to sit on the United States Supreme Court.
Today, Thomas's legacy on the bench.
I think he's planting flowers in a garden that he thinks are going to bloom a long time from now. And whether that's going to happen is going to depend on the court's membership.
Those stories and more, first, this news update.